And that's not right. And we want to do what we can in terms of providing materials and help like we can from a scientific point of view to encourage the teaching of the two models of the two worldviews, the two models of origins and history. That is, not only evolution, and we're not interested at all in laws that would ban evolution from the public schools. We don't believe that that would be the right thing to do because, after all, there are lots of taxpayers who believe in evolution, and it wouldn't be right to deny them that voice from the point of view of a tax-supported institution. But by the same token, there are multitudes of Christian people, and not only Christians, but Orthodox Jews and others who believe in creation and in theism rather than evolutionary humanism, and it's not right to have a sort of an unwritten law against that in our tax-supported institutions. And so we think that both should be taught, but strictly on a scientific basis. Now, we're always presented, it seems like, as advocating that the book of Genesis should be taught in the public schools, or that at some religious point of view should be introduced in the public schools. Being a good Baptist, I believe in separation of church and state. I believe that very strongly. And I don't want any kind of religious teaching to be introduced in the public schools, and I don't want the Genesis record of creation to be introduced in the public schools. I'm not at all concerned to have the teachers of our public schools teach the book of Genesis in the public schools. In fact, I'd be against that. I don't think that's good. Because, see, then you'd be compelling a teacher who doesn't believe the Bible to teach the Bible. And that would be wrong on many counts. We don't believe that that's the way to do. But on the other hand, this subject of origins and history, this is the scope of science and history. And we can study geology and biology and chemistry and physics and so forth, and we don't have to do that within an evolutionary framework. As a matter of fact, as we'll try to show during the course of this conference, the real facts of science support creation much better than evolution. And without reference to the Bible or to theology or to religion or any kind of religious literature, why, we can teach the facts of science within a context of creationism, the creation model, as we would call it, just as well. In fact, we think much better than in the context of evolution. But in a public school, they ought to both be there. Let the students have access to the arguments pro and con for each side, the evidence for each, and the arguments for each, presented on as nearly objective and neutral a basis as the teacher can do it. And then let the students make up their own minds. I don't see anything wrong with that. In fact, that's good education, to have a two-model approach in anything where there's more than one point of view. That helps students to learn to think and to reason and make decisions and so on, instead of being indoctrinated in one evolutionary, humanistic worldview, really a world religion, because evolutionism is basically a religious point of view. It tries to explain the origin and development and meaning of all life in terms of naturalism, of a self-contained universe operating by its own processes, randomly and strictly by natural laws and processes. Now, that's our purpose, and we do believe that the two models should be taught in the public schools, but we ourselves do not try to implement legislation to that effect. If that's to be done, it should be done by local citizens, and we think that's important for local citizens to be concerned with what's taught in the schools. Now, we also not only, of course, have an interest in public schools, but perhaps even more in Christian schools, in Christian education, in churches, and so we have literature, for example, that deals strictly with the scientific evidences for creation, which would be appropriate for public schools, but also we have literature dealing with the biblical doctrine of creation, which would be appropriate for Christian schools and for churches and Christian people generally. And, of course, the opponents of creationism like to mix up these two and say, they say, well, see what so-and-so says in his book on the biblical evidence of creation. That's what he wants in the public school, but that's not so. We don't want that in the public school. The scientific evidence in the public school. And there is good scientific evidence for creation, as we'll try to point out. Now, in other words, keep in mind there is a distinction between what we would call scientific creationism and biblical creationism. And these do not contradict each other. They're compatible with each other. But they're two different ways of looking at the same truth, the same set of data. And in the public school, we would emphasize scientific creationism. In a Christian school, scientific biblical creationism. Now, and speaking of books, I should call your attention to the book table. We do have a few of the books that I thought would be of particular interest for this conference. We didn't bring any of our public school books particularly because we didn't realize that that was going to be involved here. We brought the Bible study books primarily. And I think that that would be of most interest to you, but we do have about 60 or so books that we've been able to produce at the Institute for Creation Research since we started 10 years ago, and they're all listed on this book list. And if you don't see the books that you're interested in, they're on the list, and you can order them either through the local bookstore here or else direct if you wish. But there are plenty of copies of this book list for everybody, so be sure you get one of these. Also, we have a monthly newsletter from the Institute called Acts and Facts. And I know many of you receive this, but probably most do not, and if anybody would like to have it and doesn't have it now, it's free, of course, and you'd find it interesting. For example, this April issue, the front page article is about a debate that Dr. Gish had up in Canada at Edmonton, and they had some 2,800 people come out for the debate. In other words, there was a great deal of interest there. In fact, he had just a straight lecture. Where was it? Another place in Canada. It's in Ontario, and I forget the exact city. Just recently had 3,000 people come out just for a lecture, so there's a tremendous interest in this subject developing across the world, as a matter of fact. Well, if you'd like to keep up with what's going on in creationism, there are news articles and also a helpful semi-technical article each month in what we call our Impact Series, and this is free, so if you'd like to have it, just sign on one of the cards out there, give your name and address, and we'd be glad to send it. Also, there are plenty of sample copies of this, so if you're not familiar with it, be sure you pick up one of these copies and look it over. I might mention just a couple of the books that do deal more with the scientific aspects of creation. One do have here called The Scientific Case for Creation, and that is strictly scientific material. There's not a verse of scripture anywhere in the book, no reference to the Bible. It's something that's intended to give to a science student or to a science teacher or somebody like that who would be turned off if you approach them on a biblical basis, but this is strictly science, giving the evidence for creation and opposed to evolution. Then another book called Scientific Creationism, which is a larger book, and this we have in two editions, one for public schools and one for general use. And I didn't bring the public school edition here. I don't have any copies of that. We just have the general edition. So keep that in mind. If you want the public school edition, you can order it from the book list. But this has a chapter on the biblical doctrine of creation. Otherwise, the two are the same. Most of the book deals just with the scientific evidence. And this is the most comprehensive book on the subject in terms of documented and covering the whole scope of the subject matter that we have. And I would commend these to you for your study. And, of course, there are many others, and you can look them over. I should maybe make one other clarification about the books. This is another thing that's been just started in the news. They say that we're getting rich off of book sales, and I just want to assure you that's not the case. What little profits there are from these books do not go to me. They go to the Institute for Creation Research to maintain its work. And we do need, of course, help like that because although we've been very careful to not spend more than we get, so we've been operating in the black, but just barely in the black. In other words, the Lord just provides what we need and no more, and the book sales are one means of that. Most of what we receive just comes from donations from concerned people or churches. Some comes from the honoraria that we get in speaking like this, whatever I get here, and I don't know what that'll be, probably not too much, but that doesn't matter. Whatever I do get goes to the work of the Institute, and whatever comes from book sales or book royalties goes to the work of the Institute too. So that's where the money goes as far as the books are concerned, but there's not too much. And as a matter of fact, in order to get these books published, now this is kind of significant, I think, in our situation today. In order to get our creationist books published, we had to form a company ourselves because the other companies wouldn't do it. Now, we went to a lot of them. Don't think we didn't try. When we were ready in the Creation Research Society to publish our high school biology textbook, we knew it was a good book. It had been prepared by a committee of about 20 men, of whom about 15 or so had PhDs in biology. It's a good book, fairly scientific. And we thought it would be well received, and we went to the publishers. We went to the 15 leading high school textbook publishers to see which one would give us the best offer. We thought they'd all want it. Matter of fact, not one of them would even look at the manuscript. They said, we can't touch anything like that. We would be boycotted. So, therefore, we went to a Christian publisher. But then the Christian publisher, after a while, found he couldn't do it because after the first edition because it was costing him too much money. And so it's gone to another publisher now. And our other books, we finally had to form a company ourselves. A few of us had a few dollars in savings. We pooled together to form a company to publish books. And we've been going for 6 years now, and all of the investors have not received one dime of interest or dividends or profits or anything else. It's a losing proposition. We haven't made any money at all. But we do it because it's a ministry. And people say, well, if a state should adopt your books, then you'd have a lot of money coming in. Well, maybe. I don't know about that. But I know if they ever do get to where there's a significant demand for such books, then these secular textbook publishers will immediately get into the act because that's big money for them. That's one reason why they're so opposed to this, because the authors and publishers of the secular books have a tremendous economic stake in perpetuating the present system. And that's why they're one main reason why they're opposed to it. But if it ever turned out that it looked like there's going to be money in creationism, well, you can be sure they'd get into that pretty quickly. And so we don't expect ever to make any significant amount of money off of these books. And if we do, it'll go right back into the creationist cause. Well, I'm sorry to bring all this sort of thing to your attention, but unfortunately, we have been misrepresented in the news media. And although I don't expect the news media to correct that, they've got a stake in this too. I do want you people to understand what the real situation is. Now, it's about time to get into my topic, which is science, scripture, and creation this morning. And I will, in these morning sessions, be a little more technical than in the evening sessions. They will be more popular level. But even in the morning sessions, we're going to not be inhibited in using the Bible at all, because this is a Bible conference. And I will try to keep the technical level meaningful to most people so that most people can understand it. It is important, of course, since this is a scientific age and science has been accepted more or less as a deity by our modern society and used as a means of escaping from God, it's important that Christian people everywhere understand something of the scientific issues involved in this matter of the worldview of evolution or creation. Now, as a text in the scriptures, I'd like to refer to 2 Peter chapter 3. And this will be kind of our key text for the entire series of three morning messages, this morning and Tuesday and Wednesday. 2 Peter chapter 3. This is the last chapter written by the great apostle Peter. This is just before he was put to death for his testimony for Jesus Christ. And it seems as though the Lord enabled him to look forward to the last days. He'd been used greatly by the Lord in the early days of the church. Now he looks forward to the last days and is able to see something of the pressures and the situation that the church of the Lord Jesus Christ will be facing in the last days. He tells us about it. He gives us the instruction we would need to meet the situation in those days. 2 Peter chapter 3, this second epistle, beloved, I now write unto you, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. And you note that just in passing. He says to stir up your minds. Now, that's important because people like to have their emotions stirred up. And that's true with everybody. People get just all awfully excited at football games or basketball games, especially basketball, I suppose, here in Kentucky, or other athletic events. People just like to get all stirred up. They like to be made to laugh or to weep or to get excited. And that's even true with Christian people. Christian people like to be stirred emotionally. And that's okay. God gave us our emotions. But he also gave us our minds. In fact, we have been given new minds in Jesus Christ. We've been given the mind of Christ. And the scripture says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And so Peter says, now you stir up your pure minds. And so we need to think, we need to organize, we need to apply what we know. We need to be aware of what's going on and be able to deal with it. As he says in another place, Peter says in 1 Peter 3:15, be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason for the hope that is in you, with meekness and with fear. So he says to stir up our minds, and a lot of Christian people don't like to do that. They would rather feel than think. Well, it's not wrong to feel, but it's right to think. You can do both. You just need to have, as one of the schools put it years ago, our knowledge needs to be on fire, but we have to have both. Now, he says, stir up your minds by way of remembrance, but he isn't talking about all the secular learning of the day. He's not talking about filling our minds with science and philosophy and all that. Now, that's okay. That's important. Lots of books. We're trying desperately to build up our library there at the Institute for Creation Research, and probably you are here too, and most schools do, and books are important. In fact, books have been important for a long time. Back in the book of Ecclesiastes, way back in the Old Testament, Solomon said, of the making of many books, there is no end. Much study is a weariness of the flesh. Well, there are lots of books. And they're all okay. I've got a couple thousand of them in my own little library. And even read some of them. And even written a few books. But that isn't what he's talking about. He's talking about the book. He says, stir up your minds. And then he says that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets. That's the Old Testament scriptures. And then the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior. And that's the New Testament scriptures. So he's telling us to stir up our minds and fill our minds with the Word of God. That is, we need to know the Bible thoroughly. We need to organize it. We need to be able to apply it to our situation today, to our own lives and to the world at large. Certainly need to believe it and obey it. And that's what he's talking about. Fill your minds with the Word of God, because he says you better know this first of all, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Now that's a very, very important verse, because that is a prophetic anticipation of these two world views that we've been discussing. The Apostle Peter said 2,000 years ago that in the last days, even in Christian countries, people who know about the promised coming of the Lord will repudiate that, and they will say, where is the promise of his coming? They'll be walking after their own desires, their own lust. That is not physical appetites particularly, although that's included. But just doing their own thing. They want to be their own boss. They want to do what they want to do because they want to do it. And they don't want anybody to tell them what to do. Just walk after their own lust. And they're not concerned about the will of God or his plan and purpose for history and for mankind. They're not concerned about that. They just want to do what they want to do. It's an introspective sort of a thing. And this is afflicting Christian people, I think, today. You go into the average Christian bookstore and you see about 90% of the books deal with one's personal life. It doesn't deal with God's plan for the world at all. Well, he says, they'll be walking after their own lust, saying, where is the promise of his coming? Now, he says this will be in the last days. I'm not sure what the eschatology of everybody here might be. People might have different views about the last days, whether you think we're in the last days or not. I believe we are, but maybe some of you don't believe that. But anyway, you would certainly agree with this, that we're closer to the last days than anybody's ever been before. And this has more immediate reference then to us than to anybody before us. And I think it applies directly to us. The Apostle Peter sees our day right now, and he says that's the way it'll be in the last days, which is our day. And so he gives us the instruction we need. They'll be saying, where is the promise of his coming? There's no consummation, no purpose in history. He's not going to come and terminate history. He's been promising to do that ever since the fathers fell asleep. Matter of fact, this same Apostle Peter, back in Acts 3:21, says, God, by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began, has been promising the times of restoration of all things. Now, God had a purpose in creation. It's been interrupted for a while by sin and the curse and death, but that's only for a little while, and then he's going to restore all things. Going to discuss that on Wednesday night, when his promise and purpose in creation is finally going to be fulfilled. But in the meantime, it seems as though he's forgotten it, and people will say, well, not going to be anything like that. The world's just going to go on forever like it is. Where's the promise of his coming? Now, the reason why men will say that, he goes on to say, is because they will say all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Now, that's a very important summary of the evolutionary model. Do you see that? Men will be saying all things continue as they were. In other words, the processes which we see today operating in the world, in nature, in science, these present-day processes of life, of chemistry, of physics, everything, our old processes, everything continues now as it always was. Not just since the end of the creation, but since the beginning of creation, so even creation is still continuing. In other words, we can explain the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of man, the origin of all things in terms of processes which we see operating right today. And that's the basic premise of the evolutionary uniformitarian worldview. That everything continues, continuity, uniformity, right now as it always was, it always will be the same, so there's no real beginning, no real ending, one eternal present. All things continue from the beginning of creation. Therefore, there's no consummation. Where's the promise that is coming? And that's nothing more nor less than the evolutionary worldview, which is taught everywhere today in our scientific establishment, our educational establishment, the military, the political establishments. All of these are committed to this worldview today, with rare exceptions. Now, The Apostle Peter told us that it would be that way 2,000 years ago. And it is that way today. Let me just quote, for example, from Dr. René DeBose, a prominent biologist, evolutionist, in an article entitled Humanistic Biology in the American Scientist. Dr. DeBose said this, "Most enlightened persons now accept as a fact that everything in the cosmos, from heavenly bodies to human beings, has developed and continues to develop through evolutionary processes." Did you get that? Continues to develop through evolutionary processes. All things continue as they were. He says the great religions of the West have come to accept a historical view of creation. That is, the schools of theology, the seminaries, the Christian liberal arts colleges. You don't need to be surprised that there's a body of Protestant ministers that are opposed to creation because the great religions of the West have adopted evolution. That's what he says. Evolutionary concepts are applied also to social institutions and to the arts. Indeed, most political parties, as well as schools of theology, sociology, history, and arts, teach these concepts and make them the basis of their doctrines. In other words, this is not simply a biological theory. This is a worldview. The natural sciences, the social sciences, the humanities, the fine arts, theology, everything is premised on the evolutionary worldview. Well, that's what Peter said would be the case. And it is today. We could document this, of course, at great length. But now the Apostle Peter goes on to give us some further instruction concerning this. He does not say to adapt your theology or your beliefs to fit this just because the world believes it. You're not to be conformed to the world. You're to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And so he says, don't accommodate this system. What he says is, this they willingly are ignorant of. Now that's strong language. He says those people who hold that worldview are willfully ignorant. They deliberately distort the facts. They know the facts, but they won't have the facts, and so they will gloss over the facts or reinterpret the facts to fit the evolutionary system. Now, people get angry at me sometimes when I say things like this. I've been saying this for 35, 40 years, I guess, and my neck has been stuck way out for a long time, and I realize that this doesn't set too well with everybody, but if you want to get mad, don't get mad at me. It was not I who said this. It was the Apostle Peter by the Holy Spirit who says that people who believe that are willfully ignorant. He's the one who said it. So if you don't like that, well, then you get mad at God, not me. I just repeat what he said. And then he goes on to say they're willingly ignorant of two great events in history. One is creation. The other is the flood. They willingly are ignorant that by the word of God, the heavens were of old and the earth standing out of the water and in the water. That's special creation. Secondly, the world that then was, by these same waters, overflowed with water, perished. That's the great flood. So all things do not continue as they were. There were two great events in history. One, a great period of construction, creation. Other, a period of great destruction, which were not capable of being explained in terms of continuing natural processes. Two great hiatuses in history. And if we are going to understand history as it really is, and this world as God really intended us to understand it, we have to give complete credence and application to these two great events, creation and the flood. One deals with the world as God created it. The other deals with the world as God destroyed it. And these are tremendously important. So this morning I want to deal with the first aspect and tomorrow morning with the second aspect of these two components of what we would call the creation cataclysmic model of origins and history, as opposed to the evolutionary uniformitarian model of history. See, Peter anticipated these two models a long time ago. They will be saying all things continue, but he says that's wrong. The true record of history centers on creation and the flood. And so that's what we want to do. We want to look at these two great events in history and see the evidence for those. Now, but somebody might say, well, hasn't evolution been proved to be a fact of science? Don't you have to accept what science says? Many scientists believe in evolution. But you should know this, that there are literally thousands of scientists today who've gone back to believing in creation. When people tell you that all scientists believe in evolution, that isn't true. There are thousands who don't. And most of them, like myself, once believed in evolution. All through college, I believed in evolution. And for some time afterwards. And the same is true with most of these other scientists who now are creationists. And you see, we have looked at both sides. We have been on both sides of the fence, and we've been compelled to look at both views. And it's not easy to change from one to the other, particularly when the one you're changing from is the one which is popular and the one in which you're going to get academic prestige and get advancement in your position and all that. You leave that, then you're going to, it's not easy to do. But there, nevertheless, there are thousands who have done it. We've all been brainwashed in evolution, just like everybody else has. But we've looked at the facts, and we've reevaluated, and we've seen that the real facts support creation. And therefore, if we're going to be faithful to that which is going to count for eternity, then we better not get too much involved in that which is going to be very temporal and pass away. And so we've looked at both sides. And it is not true that the facts of science support evolution. Now, you're told that, I know, but it isn't true. And we're going to try to show that the real facts of science support not only what the Bible says, but also the general creation worldview entirely apart from what the Bible says. Now, there are some evolutionists who do recognize this, and the number is increasing. We're finding a lot more openness on the part even of evolutionists today than there used to be. They're willing to recognize that evolution is simply a belief, and that both ought to be taught in the schools, even though they themselves may believe in evolution. For example, here's what L. Harrison Matthews says. Now, this is in the foreword to the 1971 edition of Darwin's Origin of Species. Matthews is an evolutionary biologist, one of the leading evolutionists in Great Britain. He's a fellow of the Royal Society, and he was asked to write the foreword to the new edition of Darwin's Origin of Species. Now, of course, Darwin didn't revise his book in 1971. I understand that, but every once in a while, a new edition will come out with a new foreword to put it in the current context, and that's what this is. Dr. Matthews says this: in accepting evolution as a fact, how many biologists have paused to reflect that science is built upon theories that have been proved by experiment to be correct? Or remember that the theory of animal evolution has never been thus proved. The fact of evolution is the backbone of biology. Biology is thus in the peculiar position of being a science founded on an unproved theory. Is it then a science or a faith? Now, I understand he believes in evolution. He's a leading evolutionist. But he does recognize this. And then he goes on to say, belief in the theory of evolution is thus exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, though neither up to the present is capable of proof. Now, he does see that these are on the same level. Neither one can be proved, neither one can be disproved. These are events of history, and you cannot repeat history. And we can't get in a time machine and go back and see what happened, so therefore there's no way to prove this in the scientific laboratory either way. Now, oftentimes evolutionists will say to us, well, if you can't have creation in the schools because that's not scientific, you can't test it. And that's true, you can't. It isn't scientific in the sense that you can test it by the scientific method. Scientific method has to do with observation and experimentation and repeating the experiment. That's the scientific method. But you can't do that with creation. Even if it's true, and we certainly believe it to be true, even if it is true, you can't have the creator come down and create something in the laboratory so he can measure it and test it and see what happens. The way you can test it in the scientific laboratory by the scientific method. That's true. Creation is not scientific in that sense. But neither is evolution. It's exactly the same thing. Now, evolution should be testable in a scientific laboratory because it's based on the idea of continuing natural processes, things that we should see still functioning. But nobody ever sees evolution take place today, of course. Oh, we see horizontal changes, obviously, the different nations and tribes of people. In fact, no two individuals are alike. Lots of change. Different varieties of dogs, different varieties of cats, and so on. We see that, but that's not evolution. These are simply horizontal changes at the same level of information, same level of complexity, and that's not evolution. Sometimes it's called microevolution, but that isn't a good term because that's simply shifting back and forth at the same level. Variation is a better term within the firmly fixed kinds. Now, we don't see that take place, and so the evolutionist says, well, it has to take a long time, it takes millions of years. Okay, but then we can't see it. And once again, it's the same as the creation model. You can't see it in the laboratory. You can't see evolution in the laboratory because you can't watch an experiment for a million years. So even if it's true, you can't test it. Now, therefore, they are on the same level, and it is reasonable. If one is going to be taught in a tax-supported institution, the other ought to be too. Well, some would say, in fact, I read an article just in the last issue of Today's Education, which is the official publication of the National Education Association just this month, in which the author said that he had been to one of our creation seminars, and he said he was very much impressed. And he said, we might very well be right, and creation might very well be true, but he says you can't teach it in the schools because it isn't scientific. Even though it's true, you can't teach it because it's not scientific. Now, that's a strange thing to say. In other words, to him, scientific means mechanistic, naturalistic, atheistic. Doesn't have anything to do with truth, and education is supposed to be dedicated to truth, the search for truth, the teaching of truth. And if creation is even possibly true, there's nothing wrong to have it in the schools. And he says it very likely could be true, but nevertheless it isn't scientific, so it shouldn't be taught in the schools. Now, that's ridiculous. Truth should be taught, whether you find it through a scientific experiment or in some other way. At least it ought to be available to young people so that they would have the option of finding that which is true. Well, Dr. Matthews recognizes that, as he says, both are concepts which believers believe to be true, but you can't prove either one of them. Well, now that means there's no reason why we can't set up these two models, creation and evolution, on the one hand, supplemented by catastrophism and uniformity, on the other hand, these two models, and then use these models as vehicles for predicting scientific data, observing scientific data, correlating scientific data, explaining scientific data. And you can do that. In other words, no matter what you see, you can always explain it in terms of evolution if you want to. You can explain, for example, how the giraffe got his long neck by evolution. You can explain how the hippopotamus got his short neck by evolution. No matter what you see, you can explain it by evolution. Same thing is true of creation. You can explain anything by creation, so they're not ultimately capable of being tested to see which one is true. A way to do that. But we can do this. We can define the two models and then use these models to correlate the data and predict data. And if the data fit the one model better than they fit the other model, then it probably indicates that the first model is a better model. It fits the facts better, more statistically probable to be true, even though you can't prove it to be true. Now, you can always make the data fit. You can modify the model to make it fit whatever you see. And we would just say that the model which fits the facts with the smallest number of these secondary modifications to make it fit the facts is the one which is most likely to be true, even though we can't prove it to be true. And we point out this, that in every case that we know about, without exception, so far as I know, the creation model always fits the facts directly. The evolution model has to be made to fit the facts by continually modifying and expanding and complicating the model. I may be right, but it is a much more complex model than the creation model, and the creation model fits the facts directly in its simple form. And therefore, we think it's worth consideration. Now, with that in mind, let me show a few slides. I'd like to have the first one, so that we'll understand exactly what we're talking about. This is the definition of evolution by Sir Julian Huxley. Now, probably not all of you can see this, and I'll explain it for those who can't see it. Sir Julian Huxley was the world's leading evolutionist, no doubt, until he died a few years ago. And here's his definition, and I think this would be generally accepted by all evolutionists. Evolution, in the extended sense, can be defined as a directional and essentially irreversible process occurring in time, which in its course gives rise to an increase of variety and an increasingly high level of organization in its products. Our present knowledge indeed forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. And you get the key concepts there, the whole of reality. This is not, in other words, there's no idea of an external supernatural being somehow directing this at all, like the theistic evolutionists would have it. It's a process of self-transformation. The universe is evolving itself by its own properties and processes. It's a closed system, a closed universe. The universe is self-sufficient to itself. And from primeval chaos, it is evolving into complex cosmos today. And is continuing to evolve today. Now, it's a directional process leading towards higher levels of organization. And the picture that's currently taught, this varies somewhat over the years as to just how the details go, but currently the universe is infinitely old. Matter in some form is infinitely old, but about 20 billion years ago, something like that, matter came together in some primeval atom which exploded in a big bang, and then the random particles that were involved in that primeval explosion somehow, although they started out radially in an explosion, somehow they begin to rotate, and so you begin to have rotation of galaxies and solar systems and so on, and simple particles evolved into molecules and then into planets and galaxies, and then on this particular planet, the chemicals which had by that time developed into complex chemicals finally became so complex that they could reproduce themselves, and life began about 3.5 billion years ago, maybe. And then the first simple forms of life gradually evolved into more and more complex forms of life. Single-celled animals evolved into many-celled animals, and invertebrates became vertebrates, and fishes became amphibians, and they became reptiles. They became mammals and birds, and finally, out of some primate, some order of the mammals, eventually came man about maybe 4 million years ago, or something like that. So a tremendous increase in complexity from amoeba to man, or from particles to people. Or as Dr. Gish, my colleague, likes to say, from fish to gish, a tremendous increase in complexity over the ages. Now the next slide just illustrates this tendency. As time goes on, the horizontal scale, the degree of order or the energy involved in producing these things, or the information required to design them, goes up. From particles on up to, finally, to people, and who knows what in the future. Now, the creation model, on the other hand, would say this. The creator, if we postulate the possibility of a creator who knows what he's doing and is able to do what he wants to do, he will make things the way they ought to be, to begin with. And so everything would be perfect to start with. Perfect order for every system for its own purpose. And then he would conserve that creation, but if there is an extraneous principle somehow that comes in and forces a vertical change towards a different level of organization, then it's going to go downhill, not uphill, like the evolution model requires, because the creator would make things perfect to begin with, and so if there is a vertical change, it's going to go down. And so the next slide shows the creation model in a simple form. As it starts out with perfect order, complete information, and now it's going downhill. Now, these are exactly opposite. Creation is not the same as evolution. Sometimes people try to confuse these terms by saying they believe in both creation and evolution. Now, you can't do that. That's a contradiction in terms. Now, people who say that, really what they mean is that they believe in theistic evolution. Now, one can believe that if he wants to. One can be a theistic evolutionist. I myself was at one time a theistic evolutionist, believing that God produced man by the process of evolution. Now, a lot of people believe that. Probably most evolutionists are not atheists. They're theistic evolutionists. But that is not creation. So don't misunderstand the terms. Theistic evolution is simply a form of evolution, but it isn't creation. Creation and evolution are opposites. One goes up, one other goes down. Creation model, the evolution model says we can explain all things in terms of continuing natural processes. Creation model says you can't. You have to have completed supernatural processes for the basic systems of nature to explain them. So they're the opposites. Don't say then that you believe in both creation and evolution. If you want to believe that God had something to do with evolution, of course, you can call that theistic evolution. Now, the decision between atheistic evolution and theistic evolution is not a scientific decision. And therefore, that would be strictly a religious option. Whether you want to be an atheistic evolutionist or a theistic evolutionist, whether you believe that God had something to do with evolutionary process or not, is a theological decision. And that should not be in the schools. That's a religious issue. So don't say that you can accommodate both by saying that God used the method of evolution. That's a religious point of view, and that shouldn't be in the public schools. Now, if you want to believe that God had something to do with evolution, of course you make that choice. But remember this, when you do, that is a theological issue, and what you have to say is that the God who used evolution is a God who is very wasteful and inefficient. Evolution, after all, that's what it is. It's a random, meandering sort of a process over the ages, all sorts of extinctions and blind alleys and misfits. And cruel, too, because after all, there are billions of animals that suffer and die in the course of evolution, if it's true. And so the God who would use an evolutionary process is a God who is very wasteful and inefficient and very cruel. That's the most wasteful, inefficient, cruel process you conceive of by which to produce man. So if you want to believe in that kind of a God, okay, you make that choice. Don't call it science. That's your religious choice. But that is not, of course, the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is one who is not wasteful and not cruel and not inefficient. He's a God of power and order and grace and love. I tell people if they feel like they've got to believe in evolution because science requires it, okay, you make that choice. But don't blame God for that. He wouldn't do a thing like that. God is not an evolutionist. Now, these are the two models then, and the question is which one of them fits the facts of science best? And, of course, the creation model does. Now, for example, science is what you can see. And the predictions that you would make from these two models would be like this. If we didn't know any different, if we had a creationist and an evolutionist thing come from out of space and we didn't know what we were going to find, we would predict, if we were an evolutionist, that since evolution is a universal process and all organisms have come from the same ancestor by the same process in the same world, there would be a continuum of organisms. Sort of an evolutionary flux in nature, and we could see things transforming from one kind to another kind. Now, if we could see something like that, we would all be evolutionists, because we'd have to believe what we see, and science is what you see. If we could really see things evolving from one kind into another kind, or we could see an evolutionary flux in nature, we'd all have to be evolutionists. That would be the best proof evolution could have. We would see it right before our eyes then, but we don't see that. Evolution maybe can modify his model to explain why you don't see that by saying, well, evolution takes place very slowly, and furthermore, it takes place, a small group gets isolated from the parent group, and then one evolves one way and one another way in a different environment, and so you gradually get these separations. Well, that's modifying and expanding the model. The creation model does not have to explain why you don't see this continuity in nature, the creation model predicts you won't, because the Creator would create basic kinds with the provision to have the kinds vary within themselves so they could adapt to different environments without becoming extinct, but then gaps between the kinds, each kind with its own structure for its own purposes, similar structures for similar purposes, different structures for different purposes, and variation within the kinds, gaps between the kinds, and that's exactly what we see in the actual world of organisms. And so the prediction of the creation model fits the facts directly. It doesn't have to be modified to make it fit the facts. Now, evolution would be very persuasive if we were, for example, instead of having cats and dogs, we would have, say, cats, and then an animal which is 90% cat, 10% dog, 80%, 20% dog, and so on, a continuum, and then they would pretty well be evident they came from a common ancestor. But now we have cats and dogs and nothing in between. Now, somebody sent me a photograph several years ago from the newspaper. Next slide shows that, of an apparent exception to this. I don't know whether you can see that. But that's what's called a DAP. That's a 50% dog, 50% cat, a hybrid dog and cat. And so this was on the front page of the San Diego paper, and a lot of people who were evolutionist friends of mine sent that to me and said, see, you were wrong. You can have these intergrades, and therefore that does prove that cats and dogs had a common ancestor. But then what they didn't know, about 3 days later, on the inside of the paper, a little half-inch column, that's the way papers do, you know, a little half-inch column, in which the publisher of this photograph said it was all a hoax. No such thing as a DAT or a COG. Cats are cats and dogs are dogs. That's the way they've always been and always will. And there's no intergrades between horses and elephants or dogs and bears or apes and men. Each kind has its own distinct characteristics. It can vary within the kind quite widely, but gaps between the kinds so that one kind will never become a different kind. And that's all we ever see in science. And, of course, that's exactly what the Bible says, too. Now, we could document that, but you really don't need to document that because everybody sees that. Nobody ever sees one kind evolve into a different kind. Science is what you see, but who ever saw one animal evolve into a different kind of animal? Now, you read about things like that. I know. I've read about big changes, big vertical changes from one kind to a higher kind. I've read, for example, about frogs turning into princes and about the mice into footmen, things like that. But when you see that, when you read that, you know you're not reading a book of science. You're reading a book of magic. And if it would take a magic wand, you see, to convert an amphibian into a human being rapidly, what is it that converts that into science when you stretch it out over 100 million years and then say that the amphibian gradually becomes a man? There's nothing about time that will convert magic into science. Matter of fact, as we will see, as time goes on, things go in exactly the other direction, just as the creation model would predict. Dr. David Kitts, a man whom we debated several years ago at the University of Oklahoma, in an article in Journal Evolution soon after our debate, said this: evolution, in the sense that Darwin speaks of it, cannot be detected within the lifetime of a single observer. So we ask the evolutionists about that. You say evolution is a proof fact of science. We don't see any evidence of it. Where do you go to see proof of it? He says, well, you go to the fossil record, because you have to realize that evolution takes place so slowly. It takes millions of years. And these small changes which we can see, if we just let them go on for millions of years, they would produce big changes and one kind would evolve into a higher kind. Okay, that's modifying the model once again. There's nothing in the basic model that says evolution has to go slow. It'd be a lot better proof of it if we could see it go fast. But okay, maybe it does go very slowly. So where do we go to see the proof of that? You go to the fossil record. Now here we have in the sedimentary rocks of the crust of the earth remains of organisms that lived one time and died and buried and preserved in the fossils now. And the idea is you go back into very old rocks, you find simple fossils, young rocks, you find complex fossils. And this supposedly proves that life did evolve over millions of years, even though we can't see it take place today. And that sounds impressive until you go look at the fossil record and see what's there. Now, we're going to discuss that more tomorrow, but let me just say this much today, that when you look at the fossil record and you ask what you would expect to find based on creationism and evolutionism, once again, what you find is exactly what you'd expect based on the creation model. The evolutionists would expect to find intermediate forms. Even though there is a separation, say, between dogs and cats today, they came from a common ancestor, supposedly, not too long ago, in the same environment, by the same process. So surely there are some kind of intergrades that show how these cats and dogs gradually diverge. We would find intermediate forms showing that some way. We could find a whole, we ought to be able to find lots of these intermediate forms in the fossil record if evolution really happened. And, of course, if we could see that, if we could see, for example, a good series of intermediate forms showing how some kind of invertebrate gradually change into a vertebrate, for example, or an ape into a man, or anything like that. If we could see that, we'd be pretty hard-pressed not to accept evolution. But now what would the creation model predict? Well, the creationist would predict from his model that no matter how many billions of fossils you find, you will never find intermediate forms in the fossil record because they never existed. Creator made basic kinds with the provision to vary within the kinds, but never could one kind become a different kind. Kinds might become extinct. They might go down and out of existence. That's downhill. That's okay. You could maybe predict that. But never would one kind evolve into a higher kind, and you will not find any intermediate forms showing that in the fossil record anywhere. And that's quite a prediction to make, because after all, back when Darwin said this 100 years ago, there weren't too many fossils. And he said, well, the missing links would be eventually found by further searching for fossils. But over 100 years have passed since Darwin predicted that, and the same missing links are still missing. In fact, a lot of them that he thought were filled now are no longer satisfactory, such as the evolution of the horse. It used to be thought to be a pretty good series, now is rejected as far as any real vertical evolution from one kind to a higher kind is concerned. And so there are still complete gaps in the fossil record. Now, just in case you doubt that, let me read what Dr. Kitts, the one whom I just quoted, says about that. He said, despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, that is, study of fossils, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. Now, you don't find the intermediate forms in the fossil record like you would like to find if you wanted to support evolution. Now, what you do find is gaps between the kinds and the fossils, exactly as the creation model predicts. Now, that doesn't prove evolution is false, because the evolutionist now tries to explain it by saying, well, evolution took place in spurts in a small population. Evolution took place rapidly in a small population, and just weren't enough of the intermediate forms to get preserved as fossils. And maybe that happened. We can't prove it didn't happen. But once again, he's modifying the model. It'd be a lot better proof of evolution if you could find the intermediate forms, but we don't find them, and so therefore he says, well, evolution took place in spurts, rapidly in a small population. Well, it seems like to us what he is saying is something like this. Evolution is a proved fact of science that everybody's got to believe. So we ask where the evidence is. We don't see it in the present world. He says you have to understand evolution goes very slowly now. It takes millions of years for you to see it. So then we go to the fossil record where we have the millions of years supposedly, and there we don't see it either. Now he says it took place in these spurts. In other words, in the present world, evolution goes too slow for you to see. In the past world, it went too fast for you to see. At any rate, you don't see it anywhere. Evolutionists walk by faith, not by sight. May still be true, but to have to modify the model and without any evidence, have to argue in the absence of evidence. And the creationist does not have to explain why there are gaps in the fossil record. Creationist predicts there would be gaps in the fossil record, and exactly what he predicts, he finds. Once again, the creation model fits the facts directly. Just one other point, and then I must close, and that is, we ask the question, if we don't see any evidence of evolution in the present or the past, is it possible? What is the basic law of change that can take place in nature? Is it a change upward like evolution predicts, or a change downward like creation predicts? Well, the fact is, there's a universal law of science. The best proved laws of science are the two laws of thermodynamics. One says the law of conservation of quantity, other decay of quality. Total energy remains the same, available energy goes down. Now, that's a universal law of science, if there is such a thing. It's been proved and verified on all kinds of scientific measurements and experiments from the smallest to the largest, no exception ever been found. That's a law of science. Now, the next slide just makes that point. This is from another evolutionist, Dr. Blum. He says, the second law of thermodynamics has as one of its consequences that all real processes go irreversibly. Any given process in this universe is accompanied by a change in magnitude of a quantity called the entropy. Entropy measures the randomness or the lack of orderliness of the system. The greater the randomness, the greater the entropy. Now, do you get the significance of that? Here is a law of science in which the whole of reality leads towards a decrease of order. Julian Huxley said the whole of reality leads towards an increase of order. One goes up and the other goes down. These are the two opposite predictions of the evolution model and the creation model. The difference is the evolution model cannot even be tested. Prediction of the creation model not only has been tested, but always confirmed. The law of science is a law of decay. Things go downhill, not uphill. If you just let them do what comes naturally, they'll go down. In other words, if you let anything go, it'll go toward disorder. Some of the energy that you have to put into the system to keep it working has to overcome friction and produces heat. which just goes out and warms the temperature of space and you can't use it anymore. It's still there, but you can't use it. It's unavailable. And goes down. And so here we have a direct conflict between what can happen in the world of change. Evolution says things have to go up. Second law of thermodynamics says they have to go down. Next slide shows these two laws, or shows the second law. Time is the horizontal scale, energy is the vertical scale, and the first law of thermodynamics, the law of conservation, is the horizontal line on the top. The total amount remains unchanged. But the available energy is the orange line going down. That's decreasing. Eventually it's going to hit zero. The whole universe will die then. The sun will burn out and everything. But it isn't dead yet, and therefore it had a beginning. So there must have been a beginning, and we can go back to the beginning. We have to dot it. We don't know for sure how it goes, but we can show the probable trend back to the beginning. And we finally reach a point where the total energy is equal to the total available energy. Sometime back, we call that the point of creation. Now you see the significance. The universe is a closed system by the evolutionary model. And by the second law of thermodynamics, a closed system has to go down toward disorder. And yet we find as we go back, the universe goes up towards a higher degree of order. It is going down, but how did it get wound up to begin with? It's like a great watch that was wound up in the past, now running down. The first law says the universe could not possibly create itself. As Huxley says, the process of self-transformation couldn't do that. The first law says within the present structure of nature, nothing is created or destroyed. But the second law says there must have been a creation, otherwise it would already be dead. It's going to die in time, and it isn't dead, therefore time began, the universe began, there was a period of creation sometime in the past. Well, if the first law says the universe could not create itself, but the second law says it must have been created, what's the answer? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the only possible scientific answer to which you could arrive based on the laws of science. Now, you can get away from that philosophically, if you want to. You can say the laws were different in the past, or they're different out in space, or something like that. The Big Bang says they were different in the past. The steady state theory says they were different out in space. But if you're going to deal with science, what we can see in observable space and time, then they point back to a period of special, transcendent, supernatural creation, exactly as the creation model predicts. And furthermore, as time goes on, the order goes down, not up, as evolution requires. Now, how does the evolutionist answer that? Well, he says you've got to realize that the laws of thermodynamics apply to a closed system, and the Earth is an open system. It's open to the energy of the sun, and the sun's energy comes into the Earth, and that supports evolution. It's an open system. And they think that answers the problem. Of course, that doesn't answer it at all. That ignores the problem. All systems are open systems. And most systems go down to disorder. It's true that by certain special considerations, you can make a system go uphill for a little while. For example, a seed will grow up into a tree, or a pile of bricks into a building. You can make a system grow up into a higher degree of order if it's an open system, and energy is available to that system, and certain other things are present. But if you just have an open system with available energy, that is not enough. That's a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition. Next slide illustrates this. Here's a closed system at time one and time two. And there's a degree of order at time one, and at time two there's disorder. Now everybody would agree with that. Nobody would question that at all. In a closed system, order goes to disorder. Entropy increases. Disorder increases. Now what happens when you open that system? Now, probably not too many of you have studied thermodynamics, but anybody who has knows that from the equations of thermodynamics that if you have a flow of heat into an open system, like the sun coming into the earth, a flow of heat energy coming into an open system, does that increase the order of that system? No. It increases the disorder more rapidly than it would if it were a closed system. Next slide shows that. If you have the great blast of heat coming into that open system, that will break it up more rapidly than it would be if it were a closed system. So the disorder would increase more rapidly. The entropy would increase more rapidly. Things would go downhill faster if you had a supply of energy to the system and nothing else. So saying it's an open system doesn't help at all. You've got to have more than that. Now, what else do you have to make a seed grow into a tree, for example, or bricks grow into a building? Well, you have to have four conditions satisfied. The next slide shows the first two, which have already been mentioned. You have to have an open system and available energy. But every system has that on the earth. Every system is an open system. A closed system is that circle you draw on the board. It doesn't have any real existence. In the real world, every system is open. And furthermore, it's open to the energy of the sun because all of Earth's processes get their energy from the sun. So that isn't enough, so you've got to have something more. The next slide shows another condition. You have to have a program to direct the growth. You can't just let it grow heterogeneously. It'll grow into a blob if it grows at all, more likely to break up. But if it grows at all, it won't have any order to it. So there has to be some kind of a directing program or pattern or blueprint or template or something to direct the growth Otherwise, it won't grow in order. For example, in the seed, you have the marvelous information program in the living cell, in the DNA molecule called the genetic code. Call it a code. It's a program that tells you how to grow. In the case of the building, you've got the blueprints and so on. You have to have some kind of a blueprint to direct the growth, or you won't get any growth in order at all. And then besides that, you've got to have another condition, which is the last slide. You've got to have some kind of a mechanism, a conversion mechanism, a motor, a membrane maybe, or something to take the raw energy which comes in, which otherwise would break things to pieces, and take the raw energy and store it, and then change it, convert it, in a very special type of specific work needed to build up the complex structure. In the case of the seed, you've got the marvelous complex mechanism of photosynthesis, which takes the sun's energy and stores it and converts it through a process which isn't understood at all yet, very vaguely, into the work of building up the plant. But where did the mechanism of photosynthesis come from? Who designed that particular motor or mechanism? And in the building, you've got the muscle to the workman and the electrical machinery and all these other conversion systems which convert the sun's energy through various stages into the work of building up the building. And that's true in every system in which you have a growth in order in an open system. Now, what do you have in the greatest growth system of all, the evolutionary growth of the biosphere in a space-time framework? Because here you have a tremendous growth in complexity from primeval simplicity, and it's a continuum all from the common ancestor. It's all one big system in space and time. Simple way back here, now very complex. And what is the program that directs that growth or the mechanism that energizes the growth? And nobody knows what that is. There's no such thing, so far as anybody's ever discovered yet. But even if anybody ever does work out a system by which the evolutionary model can be accommodated to explain the law of entropy and grow in spite of it, it still won't be as good as the creation model. All they would have done, and they're nowhere near doing that yet, is to show how maybe entropy could be explained in terms of the evolutionary model. But the creation model doesn't have to explain the entropy principle. The creation model predicts it directly. And what we see is exactly what you'd expect in terms of creation. Well, whether we think in terms of present processes or past processes or possible processes, all that we see in the real world of science fits the creation model directly without even any reference to the Bible at all. It just fits the facts of science directly. Of course, the Bible teaches that too. And you get the same truth from either source. You can either teach strictly scientific creationism or biblical creationism, and they're both going to say the same thing finally. And both of them point out that the evolutionary model can only be made to fit by a very elaborate complexity of secondary mechanisms and modifications to make it fit all the innumerable exceptions and contradictions which it continually encounters in the real world. Well, I'm sorry I've gone over time, and I apologize, but get what you can from it. Thank you very much.